Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Colazo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. Peter, what's going on, man? How you doing?
Not much. I'm doing well. I'm excited to get into this one. I know you had a really fun weekend down in Winston-Salem. Conference play is underway, and the cycle is in full swing, as we'll kind of get into later on in the podcast. So lots to get to.
It really is. Yeah, it was fun. I was down in at Wake Forest last weekend for first weekend of ACC play with those two teams, Wake and Duke, respectively. I got to see a ton of first-round talent in that series. I'm trying to think, actually, when the last time I saw as much concentrated talent in one college series. I mean, maybe it's just as simple as like LSU and Tennessee a year ago, because Chase Burns was also in that series a year ago. So, but no, that was fun. It was good to actually just sit on two teams for a weekend. It feels like it's been a long time since I've done that. And it really helps kind of just deepen what we think about certain players, or what I think about certain players. So it was good looks for the most part for all these guys. I think Friday's game was a little tricky for both the arms just because of the conditions. But no, it's fun to see. There's a piece on the site right now if you want video and in-depth notes on all these players, but we'll certainly talk through them. Peter, we have more conference play opening up this weekend as we speak here on March 14th. We also have my Tar Heels in the ACC tournament, just 30 minutes down the road in D.C., so hopefully we can get a win on the basketball court as well.
And my Eagles at night.
Are you invested in college hoops at this stage?
My Eagles are still in the quarter. They're in the quarterfinal. They play UVA tonight at 9:30 in what's sure to be an excellent played basketball game between two really fun teams to watch. So I'm excited to stay up till midnight and watch it.
You know, I really feel for Virginia people who have to watch their basketball team on a regular basis, because that is some of the most brutal basketball I've ever seen. I routinely hate watching UNC play them, so I feel for everyone at Charlottesville.
Well, it's another big one tonight for BC. By the time anyone's listening to this, for like, if there's even one BC fan that's listening to this podcast, we'll know the fate of the team if we're heading towards the NIT or if we're packing it up early. So
I actually don't know the bracket. Is there a chance we play each other
in the ACC
our first
title.
Slot is in the, our first
in
slot
the
is
ACC
today
title, which would be outstanding.
Okay, feels well, like I'm rooting for that at this stage. Like, I don't have any other rooting preferences in the ACC outside of UNC, so the least I could do is root for your Eagles.
We need all the help we can get, but no, it was always making the NIT because of three wins in March.
All right, well, let's get into some college baseball, some draft talk. Peter, prior to this podcast recording, we were talking about our next draft update, which is really close on the horizon. And over the offseason, we were talking a lot about how this year was going to be a ton of fun to cover, because we felt like there's going to be so many moving parts throughout the year, just given how wide open was, given the lack of the non-top heavy nature of this draft class. Like, that combined with the fact that I think there is solid depth here, which is maybe not how you draw up a draft class. If you're a team, you really, I think most of these teams want like top heavy elite talent at the top, and like the depth for them is probably interchangeable class to class, but I really feel like there are a lot of good players throughout this draft class. We have so many moving pieces on our next draft update. I was telling you, like, this year's March update, which I think the March update typically has some of the most aggressive movement, because it's your first in-season change. There are a lot of players who come out showing different things, a lot of injuries. It's just your first piece of seeing actual on-field action and trying to replicate that in your rankings. I don't remember a draft year that I've covered, so going back to 2018, and maybe you can count 2017 too, where there was this much movement just throughout the board. Like, there's so much movement that's going to happen on our next update. And on one level, I think that's a lot of fun. On another level, it feels just so tough to find a consensus view on the talent at this stage. What are your thoughts on how the class has been unfolding?
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, one, with you, I do agree, like, selfishly, it makes it fun. It gives you a lot to follow on a week-to-week basis. Now, like, we're not moving guys up and down based on 1 week. But nonetheless, it's all kind of a piece of the puzzle. But it does speak to the volatility of it. And a lot of it has to do with, at least from my viewpoint, like, we have, and you will see this in the next update, like, the top 10 or so guys, like a lot of guys are slotted where they are because of how well they've been performing. And it's not necessarily a ding on some of the other players as much as it is a ringing endorsement on those, like on those guys at the top. Like, for example, JJ Weatherholt, he's not where he was in the 200. And he's been dealing with a hamstring injury, and now whoever is ranked ahead of him, that is a 100% endorsement of their talent and less so a ding on Weatherholt and his injury, because I think that once he comes back, he's going to play really well. And then some of the other players that you see here who may have been slid down, if we're even just focusing on the top 10, some of the other guys who got slid down, like there were performers behind them that are playing at a really high level right now. And then when we're going through this and it's like, well, and like Carlos and I will feel differently on someone in the top 10 or top 15. And, you know, we'll kind of sit here and be like, well, who do you want above him? And you kind of scan down the board and there's really no one there to slide above him. So it creates this whole domino effect, logjam type, which makes it really fun to try and sort out all of these guys. Yeah. But yeah, it's super, super volatile and ever changing, which will make for a very fun next few months.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It feels like maybe there's like a group of eight or so players that are kind of coalescing at the top of boards. They're the similar eight names you'll hear. But again, like I fully expect 2 months from now for our list to look different just based on how the performance either continues for certain players or changes. I don't really expect it to slow down all that much in terms of tweaking and tinkering. And it was funny, I wrote this week, I was thinking about just anchoring bias for myself personally. And I think that could be an interesting conversation just to have with you here, because I think we might fall on different sides on the spectrum, or if not different sides, at least different points relative to like where I'm at. So I think me and Ben on the Future Projection podcast talk a lot about how our like personal biases will affect how we evaluate and view players. I think the one that I've probably been most guilty of in the past is an anchoring bias that ties me really solidly to our preseason rank, because that preseason rank comes from months and months of looking over data that's not changing with players, months and months of conversations with scouts. It comes from, for the college players, most of the time, 2 years of data with some summer seasons mixed in. And so I think that just all of that information that you spend a lot of time coming to, combined with the fact that in baseball, we're constantly told to like be wary of small samples, don't overreact to small samples, it has probably led me to not moving the needle enough on players in their draft year. And I think that, at least in my experience so far, it feels like you, and I think JJ as well, is on this, like you guys are much more willing to move players quickly, which I think is more along the range I should be thinking about. Like I need to be more reactive, because on the amateur side of things, two or three weeks doesn't feel like a lot of time in baseball, in the baseball sense of things. But for amateur scouting departments, 2 or 3 weeks means a lot. And I think just trying to thread the needle of the balance of not reacting enough and overreacting is very tricky. And I think it's one that's been fun to tackle this year with just different people working on the process that have maybe different views on it. And I'm curious what you think about like overreacting versus not reacting enough. Cause like the player I highlight, I think, is the best example for me of this hurting me is Adrian Del Castillo in the 2021 draft class. I think he entered that year ranked as the number three player in the class. A lot of scouts talked about him as the best pure college bat in that class, and that was a down year for college hitters. So I think that specific label really held too much weight for me personally, and then he just didn't perform. And we lowered him. He was like at the back of the first round range, but he ended up going in the second supplemental round. So he's a guy that I, in hindsight, would have just punished a little bit more for not performing. But what do you think about all that? I know I'm kind of vomiting a bunch of words out at you, but curious about your thoughts.
No, not at all. I think it's a really interesting point to bring up, and something, you know, everyone has to manage on a day-to-day basis during the draft cycle, whether it's us or area scouts, cross checkers, whoever it is. It's funny. I haven't really decided like which camp I might fall into. I'm with you in that, like, I am a little bit more flexible when it comes to like moving guys on rankings. I honestly just I try my best at least to react to what I see and how it looks. Like if there's a guy performing, and it sounds weird to say this, like in the teens or the 20s, who's performing really well, but it just doesn't look unbelievable, like I'm not going to be inclined to move him up a lot. But where if it's like Charlie Condon, on the other hand, and you just watch him play and watch what he's doing and how he's doing it, you know, you've got a guy that is flashing at least a 60 hit, double plus power that he's getting to in game with relative ease, 6'6" kid playing all over the field. Like he's not a premier position guy at the pro level, but you see the defensive versatility. And you add all of that up and you kind of in your head, you're like, well, how long is this going to last? And hint, it's not going to last very long at all. So it's like you move. I think you react based on what you're seeing. So that's someone you can slide up. Similarly, Jonathan Santucci is a guy that we've talked about at length now for the last couple of episodes. But when you just kind of sit back almost from 10,000 feet and you compare it to the rest of the class, like you have an athletic left-hander with at least 2+ pitches, he's going to start at the next level. You kind of work through this in your head and you're like, well, how long is that profile going to last? And then you compare it to these other players in the class and you're like, he's going to get popped way before players, you know, X, Y, and Z, at least it's looking like right now. So I kind of just react based on what I'm seeing and how it looks, like how all these guys at bats look, how the stuff looks, how it's coming out of the hand, like what all of their processes look like, and then trying to formulate the rankings best we can. So it's like reactionary, but not really. And like, mm-hmm. and trying to trust my eyes and what I see best I can.
Yeah. The challenge in trying to react to the signal instead of reacting to the noise, which would lead you astray, is always the challenge. And I think while this whole process can be extremely frustrating, I also think it's what makes covering the draft and covering players and covering baseball and just prospects in general so fun, because like for me, it's always a challenge. It's always, you're always learning something new. You're always making mistakes and trying to learn from those mistakes. It's just a constant, a challenge. It's not easy. I think if it was easy, we'd have different results in draft. Like the way players pan out or don't in the draft. So it's fun. It's been a lot of fun to watch these players. And like we talked about earlier in this episode, it was fun to watch these Wake Duke guys. So I'm not sure if you want to start with some of those players that I was able to see. I also have a piece on the site that actually went live today. So if you're listening to this podcast, you can read it on just looking into 10 players who are significant helium guys or pop-up players or risers. Just depending on where players were entering the year, I think you can put a different moniker on them. But there are some high school players that have really been loud early this season. So we can talk about those guys, or we can get into the Wake Duke series. I'm happy to go in whatever direction you want, Peter.
You know where I usually lie. So let's. I'd love to chop it up about Wake and Duke and get into what you saw, because I think for me, and we were super, super fired up about the series going into the weekend. I think that we saw, and you saw firsthand, some of the stuff that we had alluded to. But on the other hand, and Teddy and I talked about this on the college pod, like I didn't like, I'm trying to word this correctly and phrase it lightly, I didn't think it was a great series in terms of like, I thought it was very clunky. Sunday's game especially felt like a midweek game. The Hartle-Santucci matchup kind of fell flat. I'm curious your thoughts, but
I don't think it lived up to expectations, because I think, and you guys have probably talked about this, given what has happened with Wake in the rankings, Wake doesn't look like the team I expected them to look like. And a lot of that just came down to defense. Like, this team really did not play great defense the entire weekend. The outfield play was tough. There are a couple botched chances for some fairly routine ground balls and double play opportunities that didn't happen, that I think hurt pitchers on a few occasions. There were some issues with just strikes. So the quality of play overall maybe wasn't that good, but I had a blast watching guys like Nick Kurtz did not have a loud weekend. I thought he looked good the entire weekend. We can get more into that. Seaver King was so much fun to watch just in all aspects of the game. I was not happy to see, obviously, that Merrick Houston dealt with an injury and had to get pulled. But I was selfishly very excited to see Seaver King play shortstop. So that was good. Chase Burns had his best start of the year. And I'm like sitting right behind the plate and watching Chase Burns is just different than watching it over video or on TV. And that was really fun. Like I've probably been more on the skeptical side of Chase Burns compared to you, or maybe especially Ben, just given some of my reservations with his delivery. But after that outing, like even me, someone who's more pessimistic on the outcomes for him, it's hard not to get excited about what he did. And even though Jonathan Santucci and Josh Hartle weren't great, that pitcher's duel turned into more of a slugfest quickly. You could still see aspects of why they're ranked where they're ranked and things to get excited about moving forward for them. Although, again, I don't know if I mentioned on this podcast, but I feel like every single time I see Josh Hartle in person, he does not pitch well. So I've never really got good looks at him, and I kind of have to go off what he's just done over the course of his career. And then he's not a 2024 prospect, but first time seeing AJ Gracia, a freshman at Duke, hit. I mean, he hit an absolutely gargantuan home run day one. I think he went three or four hits on Friday.
It was four for five.
Yeah, he was just barreling balls every time I saw him. He looked phenomenal. So he's definitely going to be a guy that people listening to this podcast who are interested in the draft in general are going to want to keep tabs on him for 2026. He's an impactful player. But yeah, we can get into kind of whoever you want to, but I would say in terms of like being impressed with players, it would be Burns, King, Kurtz, Santucci, Hartle, Massey probably. Massey didn't have a great start on Sunday, which you briefly alluded to. It was a pretty tough game overall.
Yeah, all that is great. I think one, starting with Gracia, in terms of 2026 college guys on the position side, at least for me, it's Drew Burris and him right now, right there at the top. If I'm missing someone, feel free to call me out. Like there are other guys that have really impressed as well, but those two immediately stick out to me. And then with Burns, I say unfortunately because I was just so jealous of you being there in person. I was watching him on TV, and you could tell. And I'm not sure if you got this feeling in the where you were sitting and how early you got it, but I could tell. And it's so easy to say now because he had arguably the best start of his career, but you could kind of tell like 4 to 5 hitters into the game, like, okay, it was going to be one of those Chase Burns outings. Like,
yeah, the second inning, I think, was his sharpest, and he was absolutely dominating. And that inning, it was like one of those kind of FU innings. You're like, okay, we're watching something special here. But yeah, I mean, as soon as you see 1-1 come out of the hand, as soon as you see the first like good slider that he breaks off, you're like, okay, this is truly top end stuff. And I think what's also fun about watching Chase Burns is like, he's almost the antithesis of his rotation mate Josh Hartle in a lot of ways. And in one way that has nothing to do with stuff is like just demeanor on the mound. Josh Hartle is this like cool, calm, poised pitcher, and Chase Burns is absolutely like living and dying with each pitch and showing a ton of energy, and like he just gets so into it, and I think it's in a really positive way. But I remember like his last out of the game, just him freaking out on the mound and screaming and yelling at his teammates and getting really hyped up. It's just fun to watch players like that sometimes. So yeah, it was a ton of fun. I think you could put multiple 70s on him pretty easily. You could put 50s on the curveball and change up if you wanted. And I think the biggest thing to me was just like how around the zone the fastball actually was. I mean, historically he's actually had a pretty solid walk rate in his career. It's like between 7 and 8%. It's a tick higher this year, actually. But in this game, I mean, he was all over the zone with the heater. He has a really great feel for the slider. Seems like he is trying to use a curveball and a changeup, maybe not the changeup a tick more, but the curve and change usage combined this year are a little bit more than in the past, which I like to see. So yeah, it was just overall a really loud performance by him. And I think there was one home run he allowed, and I think it was a pretty Wake Forest sort of home run where a hitter hit the ball hard but got under the pitch. I think in another park without the wind pushing it out to right field, it probably would be like a routine flyout around the warning track. So yeah, nothing really worrisome to report on Chase Burns unless you just really hate the delivery, which I mean, he might just be athletic enough and an outlier athlete enough to make that work for him.
Yeah, it is a little efforty, but you know, there's serious arm speed there. I do think he moves really well on the mound. He's looked a lot more like mobile and agile since coming awake. Like I think they unlocked something there just with how he moves and optimizing his movements on the mound. I'm really not all that concerned about him ending up in the bullpen long term. Like you said, it's 270s with his fastball and slider both get a ton of swing and miss. I'm a real fan of the mound presence. Like he's always just kind of in that kill mode, like go after guys. And it's a really good Duke team that he made mincemeat of. Like they're top 10 in team average. They're third nationally with 41 home runs, and you play and you're getting them in an absolute launch pad at Wake in a bandbox. And he was able to, again, he carved through them. And so he's SP1, if not right there with Hagen Smith for me. I guess my other thoughts on the series, and you can either reaffirm or correct me based on what you saw in person, because nothing is as valuable as an in-person look. But Santucci, for me, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and chalk it up as just kind of a bum outing that everyone has. It was an unfortunate time to have one, both with how we talked him up on the pod literally the day of, if not the day before, and on a huge stage under the brightest lights against Hartle on a Friday night, and you get all this heat in the building. I just thought everything was inconsistent with him. The strike throwing and command, the command was really scattered. He didn't have feel for his slider, which he up to this point this year has had a really advanced feel for in manipulating its shape. It lacked teeth. It lacked depth. He left it up. And I mean, to Wake's credit, they punished it. Like Seaver King got a hanging slider and he drove over the fence in left field. I didn't think the fastball necessarily had its typical oomph to it. But again, you were there. It was cold. It was rainy. I will give him the benefit of the doubt, and he will have plenty of opportunities to bounce back, like as ACC play progresses. And he's got another really big opportunity this Friday, or I guess tonight, against Clemson. And then kind of bouncing around a bit, Nick Kurtz, like no one's pitching to him. That's kind of been the story of this year. I know that the stat line in the back of the baseball card doesn't look great, but the approach is still really advanced. He's picking up the ball really well out of the hand. The bat to ball skills are still there. He's barreling the ball on a pretty consistent basis. It's just nothing's fallen. I think he's pressing a little bit, but I think that like a classic 7-for-13, 3-homer weekend is coming in the not so distant future. He kind of breathe a little bit and get rolling. Seaver King is as dynamic and as explosive an athlete as I've seen, I think, this year. Like for me, it's him and Bazzana in terms of that explosive athlete moving really well in tight spaces type deal. Like it is explosive bat speed. I honestly loved how he moved out in center field. I know that the defensive package as a whole needs some refining, but like the legs allow him to cover tons of ground into either gap. Like, I'm a huge fan of how he moves. I think the routes at times were a little bit crude, but again, he's kind of going through a position change. And then on the dirt, I was super impressed with how he looked at shortstop. I know he hasn't gotten some run there due to Merrick Houston being there and how good of a defender Merrick Houston is, but I thought he looked really good at shortstop. I think that you get a lot of versatility with Seaver King and a chance for him to, like, he's going to end up at a premium position professionally. It's just a matter of where a team thinks he fits best. I still do think it's ultimately in center field, but he certainly held his own in the dirt. And then at the plate, again, explosive athlete, thunderous bat speed, moves really well in the box. I thought, at least looking on TV, he had some trouble picking up spin out of the hand. I know he's kind of expanded the zone a little bit in general against spin, but I thought the pitch recognition skills lacked a little bit of polish. I know he punished that one mistake from Santucci, but other than that, I thought that was kind of the one glaring issue for me, was picking up spin in secondaries. But I'm trying to think of anyone I missed. Josh Hartle. I really like Josh. Like, I still think he is the type of arm in this draft that, like, as a fifth starter could end up pitching for 15 years in the big leagues. And I think I've said that exact line, or you've said that exact line, time and time again. But man, like, if I'm picking in whatever range it is, like 16 to 30 or so, and like, I know he's a great kid, like there is a lot of ability there, but if I'm picking in 16 to 30, like, I don't know if I'm necessarily pulling the trigger on that early. Now, if you get into the early second or even the comp rounds, then maybe. But if for the first half of the first round right now, I just don't know if I can take it there. And I know I sound like I'm dinging him a little bit and using and letting recency bias cloud my judgment on him. But I just don't know if I'm that all in on Josh Hartle, at least right now. Like, I think it's pretty clear, like, Chase Burns is head and shoulders above him in terms of stuff, where he is draft wise and all of that. But I thought it was a tough weekend for him. But again, like Santucci, he's going to have plenty of chances to bounce back and perhaps flash some better stuff. But I think, like, right now, you know, you've obviously got some of the best command and control in the class. The strike throwing is really appealing. 6'5 left-hander, 6'6 left-hander with an aesthetically pleasing delivery. That's all really appealing, but it's just kind of the lack of, again, like the, like, lack of teeth and lack of oomph to everything has me more in the, like, comp to second round camp for him, more second round than comp. But those were my kind of general thoughts. Again, AJ Grossi is going to be a mega dude, if not already. Macon Winslow is going to be a legit guy. Kyle Johnson is someone I love. And then with Wake, kind of rounding it all out, and Teddy and I talked about it on the podcast, like, free bases are a real, real problem for this team right now. And it's not an anomaly, and they have to clean that up. Like, you saw it for the weekend, and especially on Sunday. Like, it's cliche, and coaches around the country, like, even at the high school level, pound this into kids' heads, but, like, pitching and defense wins you games. Like, they gave up 20 free bases on Sunday and they lost by 2 runs, which is honestly really impressive. And then on Tuesday to Coastal, they gave up 23 free bases. Like, they're, like, teams are beating them on the scoreboard, but they're not getting beat by these teams. They're just handing these teams wins. And so I know that, like, Coach Walter and that locker room and the staff are a lot more frustrated than I sound. So I'm curious to see where they end up plugging all these guys in. Like, Zach Johnson, I think, is an interesting piece that can get you, you know, 6 outs or so. William Ray gives you a different look that I think, again, you can feel confident in him going inning or two. And this is not to start pontificating about Wake, but I'm curious to see how they fix these issues going forward.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I thought you really outlined kind of what these players are doing and how they profile really nicely. Just to circle back to the two hitters, I know there are maybe some concerns about Nick Kurtz, just given the line he has right now, especially considering he's a first baseman and you really need that profile to produce. I didn't come away thinking much differently about him as I entered the series thinking about him. Yeah, the results maybe weren't great, but I thought the at-bats looked competitive and high quality every single time. He had a few hard hit balls that didn't fall. I was particularly impressed with how he picked up pitches out of the hand. I was very excited to see the Jonathan Santucci, Nick Kurtz matchup, just a lefty on lefty, maybe one of the better breaking balls in the class, and how Kurtz saw that out of the hand. I thought he didn't miss a beat on that. There was one of the first at-bats, actually. I think Kurtz got ahead in the count. Santucci throws a slider in, and Kurtz just absolutely yanks the pitch down. It was foul, but I mean, he looked great. He didn't look phased at all, seeing velocity, seeing spin, and quality spin at times. So I'm not too concerned. He's getting thrown fewer strikes than he was a year ago. I think it's a 56% strike rate last year, or his first two seasons, compared to like a 50% rate so far. And I think Kurtz is such a professional hitter that he's fine to take those walks. After that series, he had a 30% walk rate, which is one of the highest in the country. So again, I think he's just the type of player who's not going to press, actually not try and like get his hits where they don't typically come from. I'm fine with that. Like, from a draft perspective, he just needs to perform if he's going to go in that top five sort of range, because he's a first baseman. But I think he would be a guy that I'm bullish on moving forward for the numbers to start looking like maybe more typical Nick Kurtz line. With Seaver King hitting right behind him, it's kind of funny because I think they have two entirely different approaches. Whereas Kurtz works the count and waits for his pitch, Seaver King comes up there ready to swing and swing at anything, no matter what the pitch type is or where it's at in the zone or out of the zone. That home run you mentioned against Santucci against the slider, it was hilarious because the two batters in front of him, I think it was Adam Tellier and Nick Kurtz, both walked. And it was very clear that Santucci was struggling with his control. King steps into the box. First pitch slider, he's hacking, and it works out for him. It's a home run. So I think that approach is going to be a question for him in pro ball. I mean, maybe he's just the type of hitter who has the bat-to-ball skills and the barrel manipulation ability and just the bat speed to where that can work. But he certainly will be facing pitchers who can take advantage of an aggressive approach like that more consistently at the next level. I would echo some of your concerns about him recognizing spin. There are some swings he takes where he's just off balance, a little out in front, and you'd like to see him a little bit better. I also thought he was a little bit pull happy at times, but I mean, he also got on 95, like several inches above the zone, and barreled it like tomahawked it to the left center gap for a double. He's consistently running double plus times out of the box. He's just a very explosive, dynamic player. And so maybe he's just going to be one of those players who is more inconsistent offensively and will kind of live and die with balls in play and how those are landing. It would be great if he had more of like a floor with walk rate. But there's no doubting his tools. And again, you mentioned it. I thought he was pretty impressive at shortstop. He had a few chances in the outfield where the routes just don't look good, but I think it makes sense for someone like him who has more of a history of playing the infield. It's going to take time to get used to the reads in the outfield, and I think he's athletic enough to play some position up the middle, even though if I was a team, I'd probably just run him out at shortstop initially and see if he can play there, because he looked pretty good. Yeah. But those are kind of my thumbnail thoughts.
Yeah, no, I kind of echo all that. I know I hit on some stuff before, but I'm in agreement with pretty much everything. So really fun series. Yeah. Look forward to seeing like how these guys build off it or bounce back from it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's talk about a few maybe pop-up players on the high school side. Again, there's a piece on the site right now. You can read fully up on it, but I wanted to just mention a few of the more prominent prep risers, just because it's harder to get that information. You can't just pull up stats for these high school players as easily. And even if you could, I think they mean significantly less, because most of these guys are going to be putting up bonkers numbers regardless. But one of the I'd say two of the buzzier players in the high school side right now. William Schmidt, right-handed pitcher out of Louisiana. And then Kellen Lindsey, who is a shortstop and outfielder out of Florida. I think Schmidt is positioning himself to be potentially the first high school pitcher off the board. He entered the spring with some of the best field to spin the baseball in the class, that has been maintained, obviously, and he's now throwing harder. He's touched 98 already this spring. He's sitting in more of the like 92 to 95 range, where he was like topping 95 last summer. So he's coming into more strength, throwing more velocity, and that's just sort of amplifying his profile. He feels like kind of a lock to be in the first round. That maybe is surprising to say for a high school right-handed pitcher, considering we only saw one of those selected in the first round. And I don't think that William Schmidt is on the like Noble Meyer sort of caliber just yet. But he has been an up arrow player. And I think one of us probably selected his breaking ball when we did best tools for the high school class. It would be surprising if that wasn't the case. I don't
know off
the top of my head who did. Okay, cool. Yeah. I mean, if I didn't take it, I'm sure he would have been in consideration for you, but he's been good. So just be aware of that. And then Kellen Lindsey is maybe more interesting to talk about because he was a player who we did not have ranked entering the year. And I also think it's a fairly down year for high school talent in Florida, which is typically one of the biggest hotbeds in the country. But Lindsey has been the guy that everyone is talking about. He is a tremendous athlete. I've heard consistently top of the grade runner, 80 grade runner. He's a talented quarterback who had a good season with Hardy High last fall. And then early this spring, scouts have been really impressed with the progress that he's made. I think there was some thought that he'd probably move to the outfield at the next level just because of that speed. But I've heard really good things about his shortstop defense. He has a lot of bat to ball skills and contact ability at the plate. He doesn't look like the type of guy who's going to be a huge power hitter, but you're now looking at like an 80 grade runner, maybe a legitimate shortstop, a guy who looks like a potential top of the lineup sort of bat. There's a lot of things to like, and I know there have been a lot of upper level decision makers, scouting directors, some player or some scouts with higher roles than that going in to see him this spring. So he's a guy who you may or may not have known much about this year, but he'll rank pretty healthy on our next update. And I think is solidly in play for a day one pick at this stage.
Yeah. I'm happy Lindsey is someone I really didn't know a lot about until you brought him up to me now and in your piece, which is fantastic. But William Schmidt, I'm with you. I absolutely love the profile. 6'4" right-hander, moves well on the mound. There's plus arm speed. The feel of the spin is obviously what stood out, at least in the preseason. It's a plus breaking ball.
Just to kind of chime in on the breaking ball too, as you mentioned it, like what's really impressive with Schmidt there with that pitch is he lands it in the zone, kind of a shocking amount. Like typically with those pitches, I'd say at any level, like a pitch with that much depth and that much spin, it's typically one of those pitches that's harder to throw for strikes. It's like kind of a chase offering at times, or just it's a lot easier to land like a short cutting slider in the zone consistently. But he is around the zone and in the zone a shocking amount. And just the feel to land that pitch in addition to spin it is really impressive to me. But sorry to cut you off. Go ahead, Peter.
No, it's a great point. Like you said, it's got a ton of bite to it. It's very big in shape. His feel for it is very advanced. And then the strike throwing is also advanced, and you combine that with the fact that this spring, at least to this point, you see an uptick in velocity. Like, you know, you've got a 6'4" right-hander here with two plus pitches, a budding third pitch. In my mind, it's a very comfortably starter profile. I'm with you. And then I think that while he's trended way up, I think that he's someone that is going to gain a lot more steam going forward. And then with Lindsey, I'll honestly have to do more research on him and dig into him. But everything that you've said, he sounds like a really fun player. Obviously someone that I and everyone else needs to keep tabs on. So I'm looking forward to doing a deeper dive on him as we get further into the cycle.
And then I'll mention one more high school player before kind of teeing you up on some college guys who are also risers this spring and maybe kind of in the first round range at this point. But one area where this class is a bit lacking is just quality shortstops. And I think that is going to benefit a guy like Wyatt Sanford out of Texas, a high school shortstop out of the Lone Star State. He has been really impressive. Another up arrow prospect this spring. He's not as far off the radar entering the year as Kellen Lindsey. It's a guy we had ranked in the top 200, but more in kind of the 4 to 5 round range than like the day one range or top 3 rounds that I think he's probably solidly in now. I mean, there might even be some people who think of him as like a supplemental pick at this stage, but he already had a really impressive defensive ability and athleticism and actions at shortstop. Entering the year, he had solid contact skills at the plate. And I guess the question was, like, there was not a lot of impact with him. He looks significantly stronger so far this spring. He's been hitting some home runs. And now when you have a guy who's kind of showing some growth in power, who looks like an above average defensive shortstop, who's a left-handed hitter who can contact the ball, who can run at a high level, it's just a really well-rounded profile that you're now seeing. The entirety of the tool set just looks a little bit more sexy early this spring because of those strength gains. You can dream about the impact a little bit more. I think a guy like that will be moving up in any draft class, but particularly in one where very quickly you run out of shortstops that you have a lot of confidence in with the other tools. In this class, you either have players who are playing shortstop now that you don't think are shortstops at the next level, or you have reliable shortstops who don't necessarily electrify you with their tool set. Sanford might be a guy who checks a lot of those boxes for teams. And so he's definitely a guy to keep in mind. Just watch some video of him. There's some, I think, 5-star out in Texas has some pretty good video of him playing defense. He's really a joy to watch, just take in and out. He's the guy with just those clean actions, moves around the field really well. You can tell he's a high-level athlete with just how he manipulates himself around the bag and on slow rollers. It's just a lot of fun to watch play the game. And again, now the bat just looks a little bit more impactful. And so he's definitely a guy who's moving up boards, and one I wanted to mention. You can chime in on Wyatt Sanford, Peter, if you want, but also guys like Trey Savage at ECU, Billy Amick at Tennessee, and then even some guys maybe further down the board, like an Aiden Major at West Virginia or a Jackson Jelkin at Houston, are some college names that I would throw out as just guys who are doing well for themselves this spring.
Yeah, with Sanford, you know more about him, and you can obviously go more in depth on him, but I'm with you. Like, when watching him, the defense stands out immediately. Like, that's, you know, his calling card. Like, the whole actions and kind of who he is on the dirt, it's just, I mean, it's hashtag suave, as Coach Pointfire down at Duke would say, but like, super soft hands, moves really well. There's like, he's a slam dunk to stick at the position. Then I think, as you said, people are kind of waiting on the bat and waiting on a little bit of the impact. And to this point, he's shown it. And where you mentioned, like, in a class that's kind of wide open and volatile as this one, there are some real areas for guys to pop and grow and really improve their stock. And he's someone, at least early on, that fits that to a T. But flipping to the college side, one of the guys that you mentioned, Billy Amick, especially, Trey Savage came into the year as pretty highly regarded, and he's done nothing but throw the ball really well. Like, he's been up to 96, 97, 98 with a really good fastball shape, 2 distinct breaking balls. You could argue it's like the curveball especially, but there's an argument that that both are at least above average, with the curveball being plus, and then he dumps in a changeup, a split change that I thought, like, again, in that outing against UNC, and I wasn't there in person, I just watched it on ESPN Plus, whatever it was, I was most impressed with the split changeup. Like, he didn't have
I'm with you. I like the changeup better than the breaking ball, but they're both solid secondaries.
In that outing, I liked it a lot better. Like, he didn't have his feel. Like, he didn't have the best feel for his curveball. Like, he threw a couple of good ones in that outing that flashed a ton of depth, but it lacked its usual kind of sharp downward bite, and it typically flashes plus, if not grades out as such. But like, it gets a ton of separation off his fastball. It's at least a 10 plus mile an hour difference. He threw it to both right and left-handed hitters. It had ultra late tumbling life to it, and it kind of just fell off a table, like 1 to 2, 3 feet in front of the plate. Kills spin really well, like, maintained his arm speed on it. To me, in that outing at least, it looked plus. And like, you've got a 6'4" workhorse frame, durable kid. I think that, you know, you're looking at a very good potential three starter, potentially even number two guy down the road. I think that's someone that you can feel really comfortable taking in the draft as someone who's going to have a relatively high floor.
I think that is key because, like, remember, I feel like just entering this year, there were a lot of college pitchers in this class who had reliever risk or had control or command issues. And Trey Savage is one guy you can point to and feel pretty confident about his track record as a starter. His walk rate has been around like a 7 to 8% range. He has stuff. It's not like it's a pitchability college right-hander who is nibbling around the zone. Like, it just feels like a pretty well-rounded profile. Deep pitch mix, good frame. He just does a lot of things well, and I think offers a nice combination of a floor in the sense that you don't have to project a ton on him and you don't have to worry too much about the strikes, and also upside because he's got a good fastball. He's got a good slider. He's got a good changeup. He's got the curveball. Like, he just does a lot of things really well and is performing so far. So just a lot to be confident in with him.
Without a doubt. Like, again, I that's someone I'm feeling really confident in taking him, whether it's, you know, the late first round or one of these comp rounds here. Like, to me, he's a first round arm, and I'd feel really confident taking him in somewhere in the 20s and feeling like he gets to the big leagues and is a potential impact arm at the, at the big league level. But with Billy Amick, he's lighting the world on fire right now for Tennessee. I've been super, super impressed with him. He obviously went off last year at Clemson after logging very few at bats in his true freshman year, kind of exploded onto the scene last year and made a name for himself, showed really well in a handful of games on the Cape. Like, the power is legitimate plus. Like, this is not a byproduct of playing at Tennessee. It's not a byproduct of Tennessee being like,
he was showing that power in a big way, spark. So
exactly. Yeah. It's not a byproduct of metal bats and all the noise surrounding metal bats nowadays. Like, the power is legit plus with Amick. He can drive the baseball with authority to all fields. It's a really quiet yet explosive operation in the box. Like, it's a super quiet load and stride, and he just explodes through the baseball. It's easy plus bat speed. I love how his hips fire. It's a super quick and tight turn consistently with his hips. He generates plenty of torque. I like how he moves in the box, honestly. Rotates super well. Does a great job of finishing his swing, easily generates leverage, especially to the pull side. And he absolutely feasts on fastballs. I know when I checked it out last week, but I think he was running a 90 plus in zone contact rate against heaters. Like, he has no issue with velo. And I think, like, to a lesser extent with how the defense has been the cherry on top to, like,
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Thrusting
Charlie Condon into the 1-1 convo. Like, I think Billy Amick's showing at third has kind of thrust him into this, like, potential first round range, because I think teams are a little bit less concerned than they were of him being like a right first baseman, right left fielder, kind of a less appealing profile. He moves kind of well over there. Like, the arm strength plays, it's still like, it'll look a little bit clunky at times, but it looks better than I expected. Like, he looked decent coming in on a couple of balls. He's made a couple of plays going to his left, to his glove side. Like, I think that, you know, you're at least going to try him there to start in pro ball.
And as you're talking about him now too, it's just funny to think about how we view a guy like Billy Amick right now compared to a guy like Tommy White at LSU, and how much closer they are, or even having them flipped relative to where they entered the season at, because the profiles now look a lot more similar, and it wouldn't be shocking at all if you preferred Billy Amick because of what he's shown at third base defensively, maybe feeling a little more confident that he could actually play that position and handle it at a reasonable level in pro ball.
I mean, right now it's there is a legit debate about it. I think, like, the one knock and maybe one wart to Amick's offensive profile is, like, he does struggle a little bit with spin, but like, it's probably a 50, 55 hit type with, like, no doubt 60 power. And then with Tommy White, it's more like six and six, but with Amick, you have, I like the body a lot better. I like how he moves better. I think there's way better of a chance that he sticks at third long term. So it's a very interesting debate, but no, he's a guy that's only helped his stock. And I mean, if he goes off in SEC play, I don't know, it's going to be really hard for him to continue what he's doing in SEC play, just with how good the SEC is and the level of pitching he's going to see. But if he continues to, you know, show what he's been doing, I think he becomes almost a slam dunk first round type guy.
Yeah, he's already been getting whispers as like a back of the first round type at this stage. And I think you make a good point. Like all of these hitters who are in the SEC, their conference play, their conference hitting ability will be more scrutinized and more indicative of the true hitters they actually are. So it'll be fun to see who adjusts well to that, who struggles and maybe takes a step back. But the tools are real. The bat speed is electric. The strength is now and loud. So he's been a fun one.
And like being around him, like in the summer a little bit, not to cut you off, so I apologize, but like,
you're good.
The body is legit. Like this kid is all muscle. He's super strong in his lower half, big time form and wrist strength. Like, I mean,
watching him at Globe Life, his
chest, like he's a super freaking strong kid. And man, I'm kind of, in talking about him, I've kind of talked myself into him a little higher than I already am on him, but yeah. I'm really fired up to see how he does in the SEC because this is someone who could keep on climbing.
Yeah, it was funny watching him at Globe Life taking hacks in game, even on swing and misses. Scouts are kind of just like chuckling at the bat speed and the intent with which he swings in like a positive way. So he's definitely a dynamic presence in the right-handed batter's box and a fun one. Peter, any other guys you want to hit on really quickly before we get out of here for this week's episode?
I may have brought him up last week or weeks prior, but and I know I kind of tweeted about him and did a deeper dive the last few days, but James Tibbs for me is someone that I would take in the first round.
That's your guy.
Yeah, he's a personal cheese ball for me at this point. It's plus bat and hand speed. Simple operation without a lot of moving parts in the box. To me, it's 60 power, and he drives the baseball again with authority to all fields. The hit tool is also a 60 to me. You could go anywhere like 55 or 60. I think either are valid. I think he's a lot closer to a 60 though than a 55, which is why I'd give it a 60 and grade it out as plus. Like it's a 90% overall end zone contact rate, perpetually on the barrel. And again, I mean, he uses the entire field. Pitch recognition skills are really advanced. Does a nice job of picking up spin out of the hand, and he seldom expands the zone or chases. And I think, you know, the plate coverage with power is really impressive to me, and is like, I think that really stands out. And the defense in right is average, but the arm again is, to me, it's a plus arm. Like that's what's going to allow him to stick at the position professionally. So for me, he's a first round type. Carson Benj is another one that's a slam dunk first round type for me. Really fun player, great athlete, moves well out in right field where he's got a plus arm. It's a little bit of a noisy operation in the box, but it's electric hand speed, consistently gets the ball up in the air with authority. And he loves playing the game. I think that's really clear in watching him play. And it was really evident this summer in watching him on the Cape, but he genuinely loves to play, which I think unfortunately has become a little bit rare in today's game. So you've got a true baseball rat with a lot of tools there. He's impressed early on. So I think those are two guys to keep an eye on who right now might not be like as notable or highly regarded as some of these other players, but who could really kind of see their stock continue to rise.
Yeah, I'm really curious what James Tibbs' line is going to look like as we get further into ACC play, because right now it's just silly numbers. He's hitting 387, 480, 903, 8 homers, 6 doubles, 12 walks to just 5 strikeouts. He has more home runs than strikeouts to this point, a 16% walk rate and a 6% strikeout rate, which would represent a massive leap from his previous career numbers. So really curious to see how that strikeout rate pans out as he starts to face more consistent quality pitching moving forward. But undoubtedly, he's been really impressive and has the tools to back it up. So, Peter, I think that's all I had for this week. Anything you want to let the listeners be aware of as we kind of get out of here?
Yeah, no, it's kind of business as usual for me over at goodoldbaseballamerica.com. Have my weekly college what to watch for piece that is up every Thursday. Carlos and I collab on the weekly hot sheet that drops every Tuesday, which is a ton of fun to do. A lot of interesting nuggets in there. We dive into each guy's performance that landed them on the hot sheet, and then also go a little bit deeper with some advanced numbers and synergy type data. So that's a lot of fun to do. And then Teddy and I collab on the weekly top 25 that is up every Monday, college podcast on Thursday, draft podcast every Friday. My Twitter account to kind of will follow along all the action on the college side on a week to week basis. And then also do some deeper dives on draft guys. And then in the coming weeks, probably not next Wednesday because the long awaited top 300 is dropping. But I will have a top 50 2026 ranking, a very initial raw type ranking, more so just getting the right names on there. That should be coming out in the next, I'd say 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks.
Nice. Well, a lot of stuff from Peter, and I'll just add that there may or may not be our first in-season mock draft of the year coming next week as well. So be on the lookout for that, in addition to all of our updated rankings and the regular in-season college content that happens weekly. So, Peter, it's been fun chatting. Hopefully you guys have had a fun time hanging out and talking draft with us. And we'll be back next week. So until then, take care, everybody. Have a good weekend, and root for the Tar Heels.
And the Eagles.
Hopefully this Saturday they'll be facing off in the championship
game. That'd be awesome.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.